Great. Thank you. Okay, we need to start this thing right. Hail to the... Whoa. Okay. Now, wait a minute here. How many of you are Buckeye fans? How many of you have never been in the horseshoe? You have got to be kidding me. That's not a fan. Yeah. I've been to over 60 games in the horseshoe. Last October, I was in my 202nd game in the big house. Now, that's a fanatic, right? You know what? Michigan or college football is not the same without the Michigan-Ohio State rivalry. And it hasn't been much of a rivalry in the last 10 years, but we shall return, I hope, during my lifetime. I got a dentist friend I graduated from high school with in Toledo. He's a dentist in Plymouth, just outside of Ann Arbor. And he has a number of the coaches as his patients, and they tell him that when they come to practice, they have no idea what to expect from Harbaugh. He's totally unpredictable, but they love the guy. You don't really care, but that's okay. Well, I have a wonderful ministry. It started in Toledo back in the 50s, late 50s. And I told the guys yesterday that my dad was the superintendent of the largest die-casting plant in the world at the time, located in Toledo. Major suppliers to Ford, General Motors, Chrysler, back in those days, American Motors. He had five plants. He had about 30,000 employees, and he was the superintendent. And May of my senior year, he suffered a heart attack and had to retire. So the company assumed I wouldn't be able to go to college, so they gave me a job in purchasing at the main plant in Toledo. And I was an expediter for 2 years. And in 1962, they gave me the responsibility of the rear windows for the Lincoln Continental and Ford Thunderbird. My job was to buy the component parts and then have it assembled at our plant by our guys and then shipped up to the River Rouge plant in Detroit to be put in the cars. In 64, they gave me the Ford Mustang, the most sold car in the history of the automotive, still holds the record. And that thing just took off. In fact, I told the folks yesterday that it was going to come out as a Cougar. And about 3-4 weeks before production, Iacocca changed it to the Mustang. And the Cougar came out later because he thought the Mustang would have a better sales appeal to the younger generation. He was right. That car just was hotter and crazier, just unbelievable. We couldn't keep up with it, with the windows. The little vent window in the back had 18 parts to it. It's not that big a window, you know, it's like that. And 18 parts manufactured by 16 different companies. Now, you think about it. When this country goes into recession, when the automotive industry goes into recession, the number one industry that's hit is automotive. If it took 16 companies to build that little vent window, how many companies does it take to build a car? It's unbelievable. It's thousands and millions of employees involved. So that's where I cut my teeth on the financial side and going to night school, University of Toledo, taking accounting and business. And then the Lord called us to Southern Ohio, Cedarville. I worked there for 5 years and taught in the business department and worked in administration. And the Lord called us out to California in 74 to be the finance guy for the Los Angeles Baptist College, now the Master's College Seminary, Master's University, forgive me. And so we've been there, been involved there for 44 years. So it's been a good run. And started my ministry as a hobby. I took a course in income tax at the University of Toledo, fell in love with income tax. And like I told the folks yesterday, you have to screw loose to fall in love with income tax. But I started doing income tax for my buddies and then started doing tax returns for some pastors. And the thing just took off. I didn't realize how great the need was. And went out to California and spoke at a conference at the Asilomar Conference Center near San Francisco in 75. There was about 800 pastors there. And they gave me 45 minutes to do a seminar on the pastor's income tax. And I finished at 10 o'clock, and those guys asked me questions till 1 in the afternoon. So I just never had a seminar on that. And so that just sort of launched this thing. So then we moved to the Tri-Cities, Pasco, Kennewick, Richland, and Washington, and really, really took off full-time up there. That was in 1978. And then moved back down in California. I was the vice chairman of the board and chairman of the search committee when the president retired, and we went on a search, and the Lord led us to John MacArthur. And the Lord just knitted our hearts. John and I really have been really close friends, and I traveled with him and did the Shepherd's Conference series across the country. Now it's the Shepherd's Conference series at Grace Church. Used to be, we do travel the country. In fact, we had one here in Cleveland. I don't remember where. But anyway, that's sort of, and then he called me one day and asked me to move my ministry down with him, which I did. So we've been down in Southern California since 1987. So, been a good run. The ministry of the foundation, it's independent of Grace Church. It's an independent foundation. I started it in 1978. And we do taxes for pastors and missionaries, like Ed said. We do pastors from all 50 states and missionaries serving in, I think it's 43 different countries now. So it's unique. We don't charge. It's all free service. And so it's been very unique. And you've taken care of Evangelist Paul for how many years? How many years have we been doing your taxes? 24 years? You remember that, 24 years, and you're still out of jail.
And there's been some close.
Hey, you'd have a captive audience, free room and board, free medical care.
Your television at home.
That's right. And then out of that relationship with the pastors comes the request to come to the churches and do these seminars. So that's your. So this weekend you're going to get a taste of the stewardship. We got it started yesterday with leadership. And this morning we're going to do the 14 steps of financial freedom, the practical side of biblical stewardship. And in the morning worship, I'll preach a message from Matthew 6, the three convictions for biblical stewardship, generosity, contentment, and integrity. That launches the whole issue of stewardship. The cornerstone principle for biblical stewardship is generosity. That starts the whole process. If I'm generous, my thought process and how I handle my money is right because it's biblical. And so we'll talk about that in morning worship. And then a break, and then we'll do that estate planning seminar. What's the importance of a living trust today? I'll tell you, that's a big issue. You better be aware of it. Guardianship issues. Court case in Connecticut a few years back that really set that thing on its head. Guardianship issues on its head, and fostered by a liberal judge. So I'll talk about that a little bit. And then we'll talk about the living trust. That's a big issue. And then the HIPAA agreement. Since 2007, I don't know if you're aware of this, but if I'm traveling and I'm in Jacksonville, Florida, and say my wife's in Los Angeles and I'm hospitalized, you know she can't get access to my health condition without a signed HIPAA agreement? Are you aware of that? That's the laws of 2007. Not many people are aware of it. So we'll talk about that too. So it won't last long. The seminar I do takes about 35 minutes, maybe 40 minutes, and we'll do a Q&A, and then that'll be it. So we'll get it on right away. I'm not going to keep it long. So I think you're bringing some lunches or something if you're staying, but I'll hit it immediately. Get you in, get you out, so you don't get bored with it. All right, take your Bible. So we're going to turn to this 15th Psalm. The 15th Psalm. Six verses. It asks a question, gives you an answer, and leaves you with a promise. 15th Psalm. Lord, who may abide in your tabernacle? Who may dwell in your holy hill? In other words, how do we have intimate fellowship with you, Lord? Here's the answer. He who walks uprightly lives a consistent life and works righteousness. He always does what is right. Speaks the truth in his heart. He who does not backbite with his tongue, he doesn't destroy or step on people with his tongue. Nor does evil to his neighbor, nor does he take up a reproach against his friend. In whose eyes a vile person is despised, he does not tolerate pagan behavior. But he honors those who fear the Lord. He who swears to his own hurt and does not change, he holds himself accountable. He who does not put out his money at usury, in other words, he's not greedy. Nor does he take a bribe against the innocent, he can't be bought. Now the promise. He who does these things shall never be moved. He who does these things shall never be shaken. He who does these things will live a solid, stable and dependable life. Wow. What a text. A lot of meat there. A lot of meat. All right. 14 steps of financial freedom. My dad had a wonderful job in the automotive, made a good wage, lived well. There were no seminars back in those days. My mom and dad lived beyond their means. Godly people. When the church doors were open, we were there and all that. But didn't handle the money well. I can remember my dad would come home at the end of the month, give my mother the paycheck. She'd go to the bank, deposit the check, and sit down at the dining room table to pay the bills. She'd lay them out. Back in those days, you didn't have credit cards. You had charge accounts. And every store had its own charge account. And I can remember her dragging me downtown Toledo to open a new charge account at a department store. And she'd sign whatever she signed, and they'd give her a little leather pouch with a metal plate about the size of two postage stamps. And the name of the store on it, she'd put in her purse. And every once in a while, I'd peek in her purse. And I think she had a charge account for every store in Toledo, and probably within a 100-mile radius of Toledo. And I think she probably owed them all. She sat down at the dining room table. She spread out the bills. And I used to sit there and watch her do that. I'm like 9, 10, 11 years old. And I was captivated by that. And I just was very interested. And I gave them money last month. I'm not going to make a payment to them this month. I'll give this one 5, this one 10. And then every once in a while, she'd break down and begin to weep. And I'm sitting there watching my mother weep because she couldn't pay the bills. That has a tendency to get your attention. Now I'm 12 years old. My cousin Dorothy has just graduated from Moody Bible Institute and felt called to Costa Rica as a missionary. So Mom and Dad sat down at the dining room table that night at the end of the month and discussed what they could do for Dorothy. They wanted to support her. They came to the conclusion they couldn't support her. They were too badly in debt. My mom was stunned by that. I can remember her breaking down at the table, starting to cry. She got up, left the table, went into the bedroom. I could hear her crying in there. I remember getting up and walking in the living room saying to myself, something's not right here. I don't understand this. I'm 12 years old. My dad makes a good wage, buys a new car every couple of years. We live in a beautiful home. Why can't they support my cousin, who I love dearly? And then I can remember thinking to myself, I'm not going to live like that. I'm not going to let money control my life. I didn't know what I was saying, but I can remember saying that, thinking that. So I'm now fast forward. I meet my wife in high school. We were high school sweethearts. And we were engaged for about a year and a half. And I said to her at the beginning of our engagement, I said, honey, we're going to put together a financial plan for our marriage. I said, we're not going to live like Mom and Dad lived financially. We're not going to let money control our life. Not going to do that. Not going to do that. So we put together a financial plan. Folks, we've lived that plan for 54 years. Is it 54, honey? Is it okay? If she rolls her eyes, I know I've missed the number. And that's what I'm going to share with you this morning. We tweak it, changes, circumstances change, desires change, things change. So we've changed it probably 100 times or more. So I'm going to take you through this little seminar. Look at your first page. Are we facing economic Armageddon? Nobody knows for sure. Nobody knows for sure. Are we becoming a cashless society? 1996, 80% of the bills were paid by cash and checks. 2013, I understand 2016 is the same. 20% of money is paid by cash and checks. Now it's online and credit cards, which means we're becoming a cashless society. Yes, it's technology, but it's also partly the design of the credit card industry. The easiest time to spend money is with a credit card. Next easiest time is to write a check. Most typical time for most people to spend money is when they pay cash. They don't want you dealing with cash, because it makes you too conscious of your money. U.S. debt, into 1995, $6 trillion. Into 2015, $19,500,000,000. Now we're approaching $21 trillion. People I trust tell me that once we hit the $21 trillion mark, that's a point of no return. I don't know. They don't know. Who do we owe money to? $1.5 trillion to China. $1.6 trillion to Japan. We owe over $600 billion out of Russia. We didn't owe them a dime in 2007. Unbelievable. What's the difference between a million, a billion, and a trillion? Take $100 bills. Watch this. This is unbelievable. Take a stack of $100 bills. It's $10,000. 100 of them. 100 stacks, $1 million, would fit in a shopping bag. 100 million in the shape of a cube, 3 by 3 by 3, would fit on an industrial pallet. 1 billion fits on 10 industrial pallets. 1 trillion fits on 10,000 pallets. And would fill the floor of a fair-sized warehouse. That's staggering. That is staggering. A million seconds ago is 12 days. A billion seconds ago is 32 years. a trillion seconds ago is 32,000 years. We're 32,000 years in terms of seconds times 20 in debt in this country. That's a staggering number. You can't get your arms around it. Look at the next page. It's a capitalistic society. It's free enterprise, free market. We are the most successful story in the history of the world. Nobody compares to us. Nobody compares to America economically. We have been the most successful story in the history of the world. Free market goes through cycles. Cycles are healthy for the system to work efficiently. You've heard the term GDP, gross domestic product. GDP is the sale of all goods and services in a culture measured over a period of time, monthly, quarterly, annually. You go down and buy a cup of coffee at Starbucks, that's gross domestic product. You buy a suit of clothes, GDP. You buy a tank of gas, GDP. That's measured. You want that to grow every month, every quarter. That's capitalistic system. That's free market. Every once in a while, there's a downturn. When you have two successive quarters of decline in gross domestic product, that's called a recession. Two consecutive quarters of decline in gross domestic product is called a recession. We've only had six of them since 1960. Only six. That's amazing. That is amazing. 60-61 was the first one. That's when I went to work. Lasted 10 months. They blamed on the Jack Kennedy spending policies. Second was 73-74. That lasted 16 months. That was the oil crisis. I don't know how many of you remember, but there were gas lines. Remember the gas lines? If your license plate in an even number, you could buy gas even number day, odd number day. Remember that? We're coming across the country in a U-Haul, moving from Ohio to California. And we got stranded in Flagstaff because we couldn't buy gas. 80-81 was the third one. That lasted 22 months. That was the Iranian Revolution. 1990, that lasted 8 months. They're not sure what caused that one. 2001 was the fifth one. That lasted 8 months. That was the 9-1-1 attacks. That's when the accounting scandals jumped out of the closet and the dot-com bubble busted, particularly in the Bay Area. 2007 was the last one, probably over 50 months. Housing market collapsed. Bank failures. Average recession is 12 months. Capitalism needs recessions to survive, to stay healthy. Why? Free market has a tendency to overheat. Detroit builds too many cars. Contractors build too many shopping centers, too many homes, and it's got to correct itself. It needs a correction. That's healthy. You just want it short and shallow. This one we just came through was long and deep because it was so severe. So what's the future? I don't know. Lord knows. I study this stuff. I teach this stuff. I'm probably as much as up on it as maybe most everybody in this room. Do I worry about it? Nope. I lose any sleep over it? Nope. Why? My God is sovereign. My God is in control. Do we deserve as a country, do we deserve his judgment? Absolutely. And if he decided to judge America, the quickest way he could do it would be economically. Could happen overnight. But we're not to be concerned about that. We're not to worry about that. Be concerned, that's legitimate. Worrying is a sin. So it's time for people to get their houses in order financially. Get out of needless debt. Don't spend money you don't have to spend. Because I don't know. Nobody knows. Nobody knows. Now I shoot myself in the foot. I think the last election was the greatest election of my lifetime. When you look at the state of the world and the state of our economy, I didn't vote for a pastor. He's not moral. We know that. I voted for someone that wasn't controlled by the lobbyists, by the politicians, had a sense of business, success in business, could look people in the eye and tell them whose hog ate the cabbage. How's that one? We'll see what he does. We'll see what he does. He's not successful, throw him out. How's that? It's going to be interesting. It's going to be an interesting run. And he's getting drawn and quartered. You have to expect that because he's in the face, especially of the liberal establishment. He's confronted them big time. Nobody else has had the courage to do what he's doing. Nobody has. So we'll see. We'll see. All right. That's my little speech. How's that? It had nothing to do with Michigan. How's that? Is that all right? All right. 14 steps to financial freedom. Page 3. Give God a chance first. Psalm 37:7. Rest in the Lord and wait patiently for Him. People are all created beings, and we're created with an emotion. Learn to control your emotions, particularly when you spend money. The more impulsive your decision is, probably the more expensive the purchase is. My wife and I, we live by the Valencia Mall, California, one of the nicest malls in the country. We have a policy. We go to the mall, we walk into a store we weren't planning to visit, see something we'd like to buy, costs more than $50, we leave the store, take another walk around the mall before we make the purchase. The minute you leave the store, you've taken the emotion out of it. Do we need it? Is it that important? There have been hundreds of times we never got back to the store. Real important purchase, right? Number 2, learn to save money. Proverbs 13:11. Dishonest money dwindles away, but if you gather his money little by little, makes it grow. That's the NIV. Learn to save money. Number 1, principle this morning, worship will be learn to be generous. You get paid, give some of the Lord's work. Number 2, give some to yourself. Maybe to build your retirement. Maybe to plan for a trip. Whatever. Build your emergency fund. Number 3, learn to spend less than you earn. Proverbs 21:20. Paraphrase says, a wise man saves for the future, but the foolish man spends whatever he gets. Learn to spend less than you earn. We're not taught that in this culture. Our government doesn't live within its means. I expect its people to live within its means. Learn to spend less than you earn. My wife and I, we got married. We set our expense side. This is part of our financial plan. This is our income. I'm in the automotive industry. I got a raise. Kept the same standard of living. Got a second raise. Kept the same standard of living. We're building this buffer. We're building this cash flow. That's what we wanted to focus on. That's how we did it. That's how we did it. Most people live like this, upside down. Number 4, don't finance pleasure items. One of our principles was we're not going to borrow money to have fun. But versus scripture, good old-fashioned common sense. How's that? I love football. You gathered that. I love hunting. I love doing things. Never borrowed a dime to do any of that. Do I use my credit card? Sure. Sure I use my credit card. It floats my cash between paychecks. But that credit card never comes out of our wallet unless I know we can pay the bill when we get the bill. I never paid a dime of interest on a credit card. Come on. It's a great tool. Should never control your life. It controls the life of many people in this culture. Number 5, have an emergency fund. Proverbs 21:20 again. Our financial plan said at our wedding, 50% of our cash wedding gifts goes into a savings account to start to build our emergency fund. That was our financial plan. We got $1,000 in cash wedding gifts. $1,000 in cash wedding gifts, 1963, it was a lot of money. $1,000 cash, a lot of money today. Took $500 of it, put it in our savings account. Took the other $500, we spent it on our honeymoon. 1963, a $500 honeymoon was a nice honeymoon. Today it wouldn't get you out of Cleveland. Not very far anyway. Number 6, control your credit cards. Proverbs 22:7. Turn to your page 4. Look at these credit card statistics. There's about 800 million credit cards in service today across the country. About 800 million. 200 million are used every day. This is July 9th. There'll be 200 million credit cards used today across the 50 states. Different credit cards. How much money is being charged on credit cards? 2001, $670 billion. 2016, over $2 trillion charged on credit cards. $670 billion and $2 trillion. That tells you we're becoming a cashless society. Presently, there's over $800 billion owed on credit card debt at interest. At interest. Average interest rate on that debt is 17%. Well, you say, well, I can get a credit card for 0%. Yeah, as long as you're making your payments. But miss a payment. Go beyond a 30-day grace period and not make a payment. Watch what happens to your interest rate. It doesn't take long to get to the 20s. All right? Average interest rate on these people, that owe money that they're paying interest on is 17%. Take 17% times 800 billion divided by 365 days, and you will discover the credit card industry takes in an average of $373 million a day of interest only. It's a cash cow. It is a cash cow. Average number of credit cards per household on these people is 6. I have a friend. You know his name. We were at lunch one day, and I shared that statistic. He said, no, I don't believe that. He said, 2 or 3, but not 6. I said, get out your wallet. He had 11 credit cards. I told him, I said, you will never live this down. Never, ever, ever. 60% of credit card holders carry their unpaid balances from month to month. 60% are paying interest on credit card debt. That's staggering. That's staggering. You search the regs, credit card industry, they know by their statistics, once they get somebody $800 in debt on a credit card, they probably have them for the rest of their life. Because they're not disciplined people. That's why they got $800 in credit card debt at interest. And before they pay it off, they'll make another charge on their credit card to run it back up again. Go to your next page. No, you don't have that page. Okay, what's a credit score? You don't have the credit score page, do you? Oh, okay. Sorry, that left off. What's a credit score? Everybody has one. That's how they measure your risk. Everybody in this room has a credit score. It goes from 320 to 850. 700 and higher is the best rated you can get. You go to borrow money, how do they know you're not a deadbeat? How do they know they get their money back? Your credit score tells them everything about you. I have a Citibank credit card, American Advantage. I've had it for years. For every dollar I charge on this credit card, I get a point. For every mile I fly on a airplane ticket that I bought with this credit card, I get a point. So if I flew from Los Angeles to Cleveland, I'd get about 6,000 points. Plus what I pay for the ticket. For every 25,000 points, I get a free ticket wherever American flies. Coach, my wife and I get 5 to 7 free tickets a year off these credit cards. Because I'm on the road. I use my credit card all the time. But like I said, it doesn't come out of our wallet unless we know we can pay the bill and we get the bill. It's a great stewardship. It's a great stewardship. My credit card statement starts the 23rd of the month. So July 22nd will end this period, from the 23rd of June to the 22nd of July. 23rd of July, I download my credit card statement. I see the balance, and I pay the balance the next couple of days. I'll have to the 12th of August to pay that bill. During that time, from June 23rd until August 12th, I have free use of that money. Free use. Let's say I have $3,001. And I'm in a hurry. I'm traveling. I write a check for $3,000. I send it to Citibank, the Lakes, Nevada, which is outside of Las Vegas. They credit my account. August 13, I owe a dollar. What happens? I pay a late fee, and I can pay interest on all those charges. Let's say I write a check for $3,001, and I mail it on the 10th of July, or 10th of August, and it doesn't get to Citibank until the 13th of August. I'm late. I pay a larger late fee and pay interest on all those charges. That's how they make their money. Plus about a 2% charge for a place that you charge your credit card. That's why you see fees charged when you use a credit card. Your gas, you'll pay more for gas if you're using your credit card versus if you pay cash. That's why, because they got to pay a fee to use that credit card. That's how it works. It's a numbers game. I'm speaking in Seattle. A guy comes up to me and says, I'm in a dilemma. I says, what's your dilemma? He says, well, a thief broke into our house and stole my wife's credit cards. I said, when did this happen? He said, about 3-4 months ago. He said, I don't know what to do. I said, don't you think you should cancel the cards? He said, that's my dilemma. He said, the thief spends less money than my wife. That's true? Is that what you just said? You are in trouble. Not
my wife.
Not your wife?
You know, she has her master's in business in Case Western Reserve. She's smart.
I see. All right. Well, that's good. She ought to be teaching this stuff.
She would be, but you don't pay her enough.
I know. All right, go back to your page 3. The issue is control your credit cards. They're either a great tool or a terrible master. Teach your kids this stuff, folks. They're not being taught this stuff. Number 7, have adequate life insurance to protect your loved ones. Pam was born in 1965, our daughter, first child. I went on immediately and bought a $500,000 life insurance policy. I'm a term guy. I bought a 10-level term. I think it cost me $11 a month. 10-level term. Premium stays the same. Coverage stays the same for 10 years. I was 24. 24 to 34. I renewed it when I was 29 because I studied the regs. I studied the actuarial tables. The older you are, the more expensive your insurance is, obviously. The longer you insure for, the more expensive it is. So I found out the biggest increase in premiums on the decade of my birthday. So I didn't renew it at 34. I renewed it at 29. 29, I went to 49. I went to 20-level term. Cost me more money. But we were building that buffer, remember, in our cash flow. We could afford that. Went to 29 to 49. Went to 39 to 59. Went to 49 to 69. Went to 59 to 75. So I got a 16-level term. Because I figured at 75, I didn't need life insurance anymore. Why haven't I have life insurance? Homes paid for, cars are paid for, pension plans funded. What's the purpose for life insurance? There isn't any. Some point in time, you become self-insured for life insurance. That should be your plan. Number eight, be self-insured at some point. Number 9, have a retirement plan in progress by the time you're 40 years of age. Turn to your page 7. This is how you project your retirement income. Called the 80% rule. You want 80% of your income when you retire. If you're making $50,000 a year, you want $40,000 a year when you retire. How do you do that? Well, start with Social Security, number 2. Listen, folks, don't believe everything the talking hairdos tell you on television. That's all they are. They're talking hairdos. Most of their IQs don't even register. Social Security will be here. Social Security has to be here. Think about the consequences. There are about 50 million senior citizens on Social Security benefits. What would happen if the government stopped sending out those checks? You wouldn't see a recession. You would see a depression, and it would be global. This is a global economy. It would be global. It would be worldwide. That's the influence America has. That will not happen. If it happens, we're gone economically. We're gone. Won't matter where you put your money. It's a fix. They say 74% of the Social Security benefits are pretty well guaranteed through this century because of the income coming into Social Security. It's a 24% issue. They'll fix it. They have to fix it. Guy like Donald Trump will push fixing it because he's not owned by anybody. They'll extend the ages. You won't get full Social Security benefit down the road at 67. You may have to wait till you're 70. We're living longer. We're working longer. When Roosevelt instituted Social Security in the 30s, the average lifespan was 58. Today, the average lifespan is 78. The system wasn't built on that. So they got to tweak it. Did you know that you pay Medicare tax on whatever you earn? If you make $1 million a year, you pay Medicare tax on $1 million. Social Security tax, you only pay on the first $118,000. So you make $120,000 a year, your Social Security tax stops at $118,000. You're 7.2, you're 6.2, and the company's 6.2, stops at $118,000. They'll extend that. They'll extend. In fact, you're talking about it now. You'll pay Social Security tax on maybe up to 150, maybe to 200. That's going to do wonders to fix the system. And it should happen. It should happen. They'll means test it, probably. They're talking about that. Donald Trump doesn't need Social Security benefits. The problem with it is that he's paid into it. So you got to figure that out. So Social Security will be here. So let's say this couple is going to get an average of $21,600. That's probably a little low. Line 5, they need another $18,400 a year to reach their goal of $40,000 with Social Security benefits. Take $18,400 divided by 0.05%. They need $368,000 in a savings account and a retirement plan generating 5% a year that generates $18,400 a year to reach their goal of $40,000. Put $2,000 a year, look at the bottom. Put $2,000 a year in a tax-sheltered retirement plan. Get an 8% return. You won't today, but over your lifetime, you could. Start at 40. At age 65, you have $169,000 from that $2,000 a year. You need double that, put $4,000 a year. Listen to this. You know what matching pension plans are? People work for corporations. I get this call during tax season. I get it every year. I just got it this year. Pastor said, call Jim. Guy calls me and says, Jim, I work at IBM. If I put 6% of my payroll into their 401k, they'll match it. I put in 6%, IBM put in 6%, means 12% of my payroll is going into my retirement plan. He pauses. I said, do you think that's a good deal? That's what he asked me. I said, your elevator doesn't go to the top floor. You're at least 2 quarts low. Your kids probably say you're a few fries short of a Happy Meal. How's that? Incredible question. 62% of the people in this country who work for corporations that have matching pension plans do not take advantage of it. 62%. You know why? Lack of discipline and credit card debt. I have a friend of mine works for Boeing, HR. He does seminars to 50,000 Boeing employees in the Seattle area to encourage them to participate in a Boeing pension match. 69% do not participate with seminars. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. It's a discipline issue. You know, don't ever come to me and say, you know, I'm disciplined in my life. I have devotions and I study the word and I'm faithful to my church and I'm out of control financially, but I'm okay. No, you're not. No, you're not. You just compromise your life. It's all part of the package. Come on, people. The Christian life is a disciplined life. You can't pick and choose. It's a package. Where's the amens? Okay, go back to your page 3. Number 10, own your home debt-free by the time you're 65. Our financial plan said we're going to have a home paid for by the time I hit 54. People were creatures of habit. If you have a goal, chances are you'll hit it. If you don't have a goal, chances are you won't hit it. Our goal was to have a home paid for when I hit 54. Well, we hit it. Number 11, have a workable budget. Oh, there he goes. Going to talk about budgeting. You better believe it, I am. Turn to page 5. Can't make financial progress without a budget. Church can't make financial progress without a budget. A business can't make financial progress without a budget. Exercise preparing a budget is more important than attempt to control that budget. Page 5. The process for preparing a budget defines who you are and what's important. The control aspect is mechanical.